This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Avatar, The Last Airbender, The Shadow of Kyoshi by F.C. Yee with Michael Dante DiMartino. This book is read by Nancy Wu.
Author's note. So I tell this story a lot at panels and interviews, but I want to preserve it for posterity here. During a time when I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and before I had ever written a novel, I thought about becoming a TV writer. To become a TV writer, you have to demonstrate your skills by writing a spec script, an episode of a currently running show, essentially fan fiction. I had just watched Book 2, Earth, of the original Atla, so I wrote a spec script where Sokka feels bad about not being a bender and finds a cool master to train him. In my spec script, he was going to learn to fight with Wing Chun and Gadshi. In retrospect, the result would have been a lot like Asami. From these creative beginnings, I would never have dreamed that in the future, I'd be establishing canon for the Avatar world. In the truest sense, I have you, the fans, to thank for this opportunity. You've kept your love for this universe burning brightly for more than a decade, and the most I could ever hope for as a fellow fan and author is to add to your enjoyment. These books are dedicated to you. Thank you all so much. Sincerely, F.C. Yee.
Prologue.
Boy!
Yun clawed at his own neck until he drew blood. The feeling of slime and teeth lingered on his skin.
Boy, stop your sniveling.
He remembered Genju lighting the incense. He remembered the sticky sweet smell and the deadness it created in his limbs. Sting jelly venom, his training told him. He'd only just started his doses with Sifu Amok. Yun blinked and tried to make sense of his surroundings. His hands clawed into wet, porous moss when it should have been the dust of the mining town under his fingernails. He was in a mangrove forest. The sky was the color of acid. He crawled around, the juices of a swamp sucking at his knees. The trunks of the leafless trees twisted and gnarled, as high as hills, barely lighter in color than silhouettes. Screened by the loose weave of branches, a great glowing eye stared at him. It was the eye that had spoken. The eye that told him he wasn't the... A pain, terrible and familiar, racked his stomach and folded him in two. His forearms splashed into the swamp water. The landscape around him began to shake, not from earthbending, but from something rawer and more uncontrollable. He wasn't. End of sentence. He was nothing. The shallow water danced. Raindrops on a drum, spiking into geysers. The shoreline swayed, rattling the trees, bucking and clashing them together like the antlers of beasts locked in combat. Yun dashed his head against the ground in a frenzied corruption of a student bowing to their master.
Genju.
His entire mind was a screamed name, a single screeching tone on a broken flute. His skull thudded against the brackish mud.
Genju! Stop it, you miserable little brat!
The eye roared. Despite its anger, it shrank back from him, afraid of his throes of agony. The ground squeezed and fluttered, the heartbeat of a man falling to his death, pounding louder and louder before the final impact. Yun wanted it to stop. He wanted the anguish to end. It hurt so much to see everything he'd worked for shredded to sparks and dust. It was destroying him from the inside.
So let it out.
The whisper came to him in his own voice, not the eyes, not Genju's.
Put the pain outside. Put it somewhere else,
on someone else. The rip started at his feet, a pinprick in overstretched silk. The tear birthed itself in the water and raced into the banks of the earth like lightning cracking the sky. The ground split apart, releasing all its quaking tension in one swift cataclysmic burst. And then, stillness. Yun could breathe again. He could see. The trembling had worn itself out, spent its energy in the creation of a long lesion in the ground, an unnatural wound upon the landscape. Swamp water poured into the injury, masking a depth he knew he shouldn't explore. Things were so much clearer when there was relief. Yun used this moment of respite to look around. The musty grove resembled no forest he'd ever seen. The dim light in the sky came from no discernible sun. This place was a hazy reflection of a real landscape, painted with ink that had been thinned too much. I'm in the spirit world. He backed away from the ravine that lay before him, not wanting to be dragged in by the force of the water's flow. Turning around, he pulled himself to drier footing, using the exposed roots of a leathery tree. The air smelled like sulfur and rot. Master Kelsung had told him about the spirit world. It was supposed to be a beautiful wild place, full of creatures beyond imagining. The realm of the spirits was a mirror held up to its visitors, a reflection of your emotions, a reality that shaped around your own spirit's intangible projection. Yun flexed his fingers, finding them as solid as they could be. He wondered if the gentle monk had ever explored a nightmarish bog like this one. They'd never talked about what happened if you entered the spirit world while you were still in your body. The rustle of branches gave him a start and reminded him he wasn't alone. The eye. It watched carefully from the darkness of the forest, circling him on translucent appendages studded with what he knew to be human teeth. He'd felt its bite back in the mountains when it had sampled his blood. A pulsing panic rushed through the chambers of his heart. Yun knew he was on borrowed time. He tried to remember what Genju had called the spirit. Father, glowworm? The eye suddenly rushed closer, socketing itself in the gap between two nearby trees. Yun shrieked and fell backward on his elbows. He'd made a mistake. A crucial, invisible barrier had been broken by saying the name aloud, and now he was more connected and vulnerable to it than ever.
I call myself that, the spirit said.
Father Glowworm's pupil darted around unnervingly, the iris squeezing narrower. Its gaze had the heft of a probing tongue.
Now, child, I believe you owe me your name.
Like a fool, Yun had fallen into the role of the bumpkin from cautionary Earth Kingdom folk tales, the poor field hand or woodcutter who fell under a curse, or was simply eaten. He could only think of how he'd be consumed, rasped into pulp, maybe, and absorbed into the slime. My name is Yun. His palms were slick with fear. In some of those tales, the stupid boy survived through sheer pluck. Yun was already prey. His only chance was to become interesting prey. His poise was failing him. His slickness under pressure that had impressed the Fire Lord and the Earth King, the chieftains of the water tribes and head abbots of the air temples alike, was nowhere to be found. Maybe Avatar Yun had the confidence to talk his way out of this, but no such person existed anymore. Father Glowworm shifted in the trees,
and Yun knew he was going to die if he didn't say something quick. His mind leaped back to the moments in his past when his fate was cradled in someone else's hands. "I wish to submit myself for consideration as your student," he yelped. Was there a way for a single eye to look surprised? The forest was silent except for the rush of falling water.
"I kneel before you as a humble spiritual traveler seeking answers," Yun said.
He shifted around so his posture matched his words.
"Please teach me the ways of the spirit world. I beseech you."
Father Glowworm burst into laughter. It had no lids to narrow, but its sphere tilted upward in the universal direction of amusement.
"Boy, do you think this is a game?"
"Everything is a game," Yun thought, trying to still his shaking. "I will draw this one out as far as I can. I will survive a turn longer." There was no more Avatar Yun. He would have to be Yun the Swindler again.
"I can hardly be faulted for wanting to ask questions of a spirit wiser than the best of humanity."
When in doubt, flatter the mark.
"The Earth Kingdom's finest sages couldn't identify the Avatar for 16 years, and yet you did it in a matter of seconds."
"You don't fight the kind of battle Kuruk and I did, and not be able to recognize your opponent's spirit. I could already feel Genju bringing his reincarnation closer to one of my tunnels. It had to be one of you children."
Yun's ears perked at the word tunnels.
"You have routes to the human world? More than one?"
Father Glowworm laughed again.
"I know what you're doing," it sneered, "and it doesn't impress me. Yes, I can create passages to the human realm. No, you will not trick or convince me into sending you back. You're not the bridge between spirits and humans, boy. You're the stone that needed to be pitched away by the sculptor. The impurity in the ore. I've tasted your blood, and you're nothing. You're not even worth this conversation."
The eye crept closer.
"I can tell how upset you are by the truth," it said in a soothing, sweet tone. "Don't be. Who needs avatarhood? You will find your own use and your own immortality. Once I strengthen myself on your blood, part of your essence will exist within me forever."
The problem with any game was that eventually the opponent decided to stop playing. Father Glowworm suddenly rushed Yun, spiraling through the forest, tendrils of slime grasping and parting the trees like the beads of a curtain.
"Now be grateful," the spirit roared, "for we are about to become one."
Unfinished business. Brother Po once told Kuji the nickname for the Dao sword was All Man's Courage. Hold the sturdy chopping blade that let you hack away at a foe with abandon, and you'd feel braver immediately. Kuji did not feel braver as he gripped the haft of his Dao with clammy palms and watched the door. And his blade did not feel very sturdy. It was a rusted, chipped specimen that seemed like it would shatter if he waved it in the air too vigorously. As the most junior member of the Triad of the Golden Wing, he'd had to wait at the back of the line as weapons were passed out in turn. This sword had come from the bottom of the crate.
"Now you're a real soldier, eh?"
someone had joked at the time. Not like the rest of us hatchet men.
Brother Poe stood by the doorway, holding his small axe, the favored weapon of most of the triad's seasoned fighters. He looked calm on the outside, but Kuji could see his throat bobbing up and down repeatedly as he swallowed, the same way it did when he was going for a big money play in Pie Show. If Kuji had confidence in anything for protection, it was in his gang's turf. Longkou City Block was practically a fortress. On the surface, Longkou looked no different than its neighboring districts of Ba Sing Se's lower ring. The visible portion on the block rose a haphazard couple of stories into the air like a budding mushroom, in defiance of gravity and sound architecture. But it was an open secret that the complex extended illegally into the ground, layer by layer, far below the surface. Each level had been dug out below the previous one, without a solid plan or understanding of safety, shored up by using only improvised supports of wood scrap, mud brick, bits of rusty scavenged metal. And yet, Longkou held solid without caving in, possibly with the aid of the spirits. The inside of the block was a knot of twists and turns, staircases and empty shafts. Hives of squalid apartments squeezed the available pathways into narrow choke points. Longkou was littered with natural traps like the room where Kuji and Po waited, which was one of the reasons why lawmen never went inside the city block. Until now. The boss had gotten a tip that the Golden Wing's stronghold was going to be hit this very day. Every brother was to take up positions until the threat was gone. Kuji didn't know what kind of enemy could get his elders so riled up. By his guess, it would have taken more lawmen than the lower ring possessed in order to lay siege to Longkou. Regardless, the plan was sound. Anyone trying to make it to the lower floors would have to file through a narrow bottleneck that ran by this room. Kuji and Ning could get the drop on an intruder, 2-on-1. And it was unlikely they'd see action, Kuji reminded himself. The level above was being prowled by throat-cutter Gong, the boss's best assassin. Gong could stalk and kill a mongoose lizard in its own jungle lair. The number of heads he'd taken could have filled a hay barn. A crash came from one floor up. There was no sound of a voice accompanying it. The little apartment began to feel less their turf to hold, and more a box confining them like animals in a crate. Po gestured with his hatchet.
"We'll hear them coming down the stairs," he whispered. "That's when we strike."
Kuji tilted his ear in that direction. He was so desperate to hear any approaching signal that he lost his balance and stumbled. Po rolled his eyes.
"Too loud," he hissed.
As if to prove his point, someone flew through the doorway, snapping the hinges and collided with Kuji. He shrieked and flailed with his dao, but at best managed to smack the person in the head with his pommel. Po grabbed the attacker and raised his hatchet to strike, but checked his swing at the last second. It was throat-cutter Gong, unconscious and bleeding. His wrists bent the wrong way, and his ankles were bound with his own garrote wire.
"Brother Gong," Po shouted, forgetting his own lesson in stealth. "What happened?"
From the wall opposite the hallway they were supposed to be focusing on, a pair of gauntleted arms burst through the brick. They wrapped around Po's neck from behind in a chokehold, cutting off his words. Kuji saw his elder's eyes go white with terror before Po was pulled out of the room straight through the wall. Kuji stared at the emptiness in stupefied disbelief. Po was a big man, and in a blink, he'd been taken like a raven eagle's prey. The hole he disappeared through revealed only darkness. Outside, the floorboards creaked from the weight of a person walking, as if complete silence were a cloak the enemy could wear and discard at will. The treading of heavy boots came closer and closer. The doorway filled, blacking out the faint light from the hall, and a tall, incredibly tall figure stepped inside. A thin line of blood trickled from its throat, as if it had been beheaded and glued back together. A dress of green silk billowed underneath the wound. Its face was a white mask, and its eyes were monstrous streaks of red. Trembling, Kuji raised his blade. He moved so slowly it felt like he was swimming through mud. The creature watched him swing his sword, its eyes on the metal, and somehow he knew it was fully capable of putting a stop to the action, if it cared to. The edge of the dao bit into his opponent's shoulder. There was a snapping noise, and a sudden pain lashed his cheek. The sword had broken, the top half bouncing back in Kuji's face. It was a spirit. It had to be. It was a spirit that could pass through walls, a ghost that could float over floors, a beast impervious to blades. Kuji dropped the handle of the useless sword. His mother had told him once that invoking the Avatar could safeguard him from evil. He'd known as a child she was making up stories, but that didn't mean he couldn't decide to believe them right now. Right now, he believed harder than he believed anything in his life. "The Avatar protect me," he whispered while he could still speak. He fell on his behind and scrambled to the corner of the room, blanketed completely by the spirit's long shadow. "Yang Chen, protect me!" The spirit woman followed him and lowered her red and white face to his. A human would have passed some kind of judgment on Kuji as he cowered like this. The cold disregard in her eyes was worse than any pity or sadistic amusement. "Yang Chen isn't here right now," she said in a rich, commanding voice that would have been beautiful had she not held such clear indifference for his life. "I am." Kuji sobbed as a large, powerful hand gripped him by the chin with thumb and forefinger. It was gentle, but gave the assurance that she could rip his jaw clean off his head if she so desired. The woman tilted his face upward. "Now tell me where I can find your boss." Kyoshi's neck itched terribly. The garrote had been coated in ground glass, and though she'd managed to avoid getting cut too deeply, sharp little fragments still vexed her skin. It served her right for being so sloppy. The gang's wire man had been stealthy, but not at the level of the company she used to keep in her Daofei days. Speaking of which, she'd taken a risk by not incapacitating the boy like she'd done his elders. But he'd reminded her of Lek. The way his stupid baby face tried to arrange itself in a mask of hardness, his obvious need for the approval of his sworn elder brothers. His sheer, idiotic bravery. He was too young to be running with a gang in the slums of Ba Sing Se. "No more exceptions for today," she told herself as she stepped over rusting junk and debris. She was still in the habit of labeling anyone roughly her age as boys and girls, and the language made her inclined toward softness, which was dangerous. Certainly no one would show Kyoshi grace because she was only nearing 18. The Avatar did not have the luxury of being a child. She pushed through a hallway barely wider than she was. Only the slightest cracks of illumination came through the walls. Glowing crystals were expensive, and candles were a fire risk, making light a premium in Longkou. Networks of pipes dripped above her, pattering on the gilded headdress she wore, despite the cramped environment. She'd learned to account for the height it added, and having to stoop had been a fact of her life since childhood. The smell of human density wafted through the corridors, a concoction of sweat and drying paint. She could only imagine what the lower levels offered the nose. The city block packed more people into its limits than any other in the lower ring, and not all of its residents were criminals. Longkou was a haven for the very poor. People with nowhere else to go squatted here and applied their industries, eking out livings as garbage pickers, fell off the wagon marketeers, unlicensed doctors, dodgy snack vendors, and the like. They were ordinary Earth Kingdom citizens trying to get by on the margins of the law. Her folk, essentially. The shadowed confines of the city block were also home to a more violent sort, evolving gangs of the lower ring whose memberships were swelling from the influx of Daofei. Bandits who could no longer hold territory in the countryside were fleeing for the cover of Ba Sing Se and other large cities, blending in with the populace, hiding among the same refuge-seeking citizens they'd brutalized in years past. Those were not Kyoshi's folk. In fact, many of them were running from her. But given it was just as likely for an apartment to be holding scared residents who had nothing to do with her quarry, Kyoshi was keeping her movements in check. Garden variety earthbending that ripped up huge chunks of the surroundings would cause a dangerous collapse and harm innocents. The interior opened into a small market area. She passed a room full of barrels leaking bright ink over the floor, a home dyeing operation, and an empty butcher stall clouded with buzzing ant flies. Genju's study had contained his notes on the political and economic situation of Ba Sing Se, and the small reference to the city block noted how enterprising its residents were. Curiously, it also mentioned that the land it was built on held some value due to its prominent location in the lower ring. Merchants in the middle ring had tried to purchase the block in the past and evict the residents, but the dangers of the gangs had always made such projects fail. Kyoshi paused near a vat of spoiled mango pomace. This was her spot. She bent an assortment of rock debris into a small circle and stood on it. She crossed her arms over her chest to make the smallest cross-section possible. Before she went, though, she noticed a tiny object in the corner. It was a toy, a doll made of rags scavenged from a fine lady's dress. Someone in the block had gone through great effort to sew a doll made of fabric from the upper ring for their child. Kyoshi stared at it until she blinked, remembering why she was here. She stamped down with her foot. Her little platform of earth, held together by her bending, turned as hard as the point of an auger. It burst through the clay tiles and rotting struts of wood, dropping her fast enough to make her guts lurch. She plunged through the floor and into the next level down before doing it again and again. Genju's tactical manuals noted that in enclosed fights, most casualties happened at doorways and stairs. Kyoshi had decided to skip over those parts of the building and bore her own passage. She counted 14 stories, more than she'd estimated, until she came crashing through the ceiling of a room that was solid earth underneath. The bottom of Longkou. Kyoshi stepped off her platform, dust and crumbs of masonry cascading off her arms, and looked around. There were no walls in here, only supporting columns that propped up the great weight of the levels above. So the city block has a ballroom, she thought wryly. The empty expanse was similar to the entertaining halls of wealthy nobles like Liu Beifong. There was a space like this in the Avatar's mansion in Yokoya. She could see all the way to the far end, since the walls held lumps of glowing crystal, as if the light for the entire building had been hoarded for this room. There was a desk, a wooden island in the emptiness, and behind the desk was a man who hadn't given up his pretensions since Kyoshi had last seen him. Hello, Uncle Mok, Kyoshi said. It's been a while, hasn't it? Mok, the former second-in-command of the Yellowneck Daofei, goggled his eyes in surprise. Kyoshi was like a curse he couldn't shake,
You!
He fumed, shrinking slightly behind the furniture, as if it could protect him.
What are you doing here?
I heard rumors about a new boss settling into Longkou and thought he sounded very familiar. So I came to investigate. I heard this group is calling itself a triangle now. Do I have that right? Something with three sides? Kyoshi found it hard to keep track. The Daofei who were funneling into the cities brought their grandiose customs of secrecy and tradition into the realm of urban petty crimes.
The Triad of the Golden Wing,
he yelled, infuriated by her disinterest in his rituals. But Kyoshi was long past caring about the feelings of men like Mok. He could throw whatever tantrum he desired. The drumming of feet grew louder. The men Kyoshi had bypassed on the middle floors came filing into the room, surrounding her. They brandished axes and cleavers and daggers. Mok's men had preferred outlandish weapons when they still roamed the countryside, but here in the city, they'd abandoned the 9-ring swords and meteor hammers for simpler arms that could be hidden in a crowd. Bolstered by more than 2 dozen men, Mok turned calmer.
Well, girl, what is it you want? Besides checking in on your elders.
I want you all to surrender your weapons, vacate the premises, and march yourselves to a magistrate's courthouse for judgment. The nearest one is 7 blocks from here.
Several of the hatchet men burst out laughing. The corner of Mok's mouth turned upward. Kyoshi might be the Avatar, but she was vastly outnumbered and trapped in an enclosed space.
We refuse,
he said with an exaggerated roll of his hand.
All right, then. In that case, I only have one question.
Kyoshi cast her gaze around the room.
Are you sure this is all of you?
The triad members glanced at each other. Mok's face swelled with rage, reddening like a berry in the sun. It wasn't insolence so much as pragmatism, her instinct for tidiness and efficiency rising to the surface.
If not, I can wait until everyone arrives, Kyoshi said. I don't want to have to go back and check each floor.
Tear her apart, Mok screamed.
The hatchet men charged from all directions. Kyoshi drew one of her fans. 2 would have been a bit much. Kyoshi stepped over the groaning bodies. When one of the triad members was too still, she nudged him with her boot until she saw signs of breathing. Mok's robe had blown off in the scuffle. He managed to budge the chair he was sitting on a few inches in flight before Kyoshi put her hand on his shoulder, pressing him back into his seat.
No need to get up yet, uncle, she said.
Past enmity or not, he was still older than her. Mok roiled with an anger and fear that Kyoshi could feel through her grip.
So you're going to murder me in cold blood like you did Shu. May you be ripped apart by thunderbolts and many knives for slaying your sworn brothers.
Kyoshi found herself bothered, more than she should have been, by Mok calling her a murderer. She and Shu Ping An had agreed to a duel, and the man immediately tried to kill her. Once she'd gained the upper hand, she'd given him a chance to yield. The former leader of the Yellownecks had amply demonstrated he was beyond saving. And yet, during sleepless nights, she thought about Shu. The vile man infected her thoughts when she could have been dreaming of those she loved. She thought about Shu a great deal, his weight in her hands, and how, at the end of their fight, she'd decided. Kyoshi cleared her head.
Anything goes on the Lei Tai, she said.
Justifying the act out loud was bitter, ineffective medicine that she forced herself to swallow anyway.
I'm not going to kill you.
You and your men got a foothold inside the walls rather quickly
for a gang of countryside bandits who spent most of their history bullying farmers. You have a contact in Bossing Se helping you, and I want to know who it is. Mok stiffened with purpose. True Daofei never surrendered information to the authorities, even if it would benefit them.
The day I squeal to you, girl, is the day I... Ah!
Kyoshi reminded him that times had changed since they first met, with a crushing squeeze of her fingers. She dented the nerves of his arm until the terms of their new relationship sunk in.
It was someone from the middle ring,
Mok said, once he stopped squealing in pain.
We used go-betweens. I don't know their name.
Kyoshi let go and took a step back. She'd been expecting him to name a lower ring criminal, a local who'd maybe sworn brotherhood to him in the past. The middle ring was the domain of merchants and academics. Something didn't add up here. Mok clutched his shoulder and scrambled away from the desk.
Why?
He shouted at a door behind him.
Now!
In her distraction, Kyoshi had forgotten the third leading brother of the former Yellow Necks. The door burst open in an ambush before Kyoshi could react. Brother Y sprung out, knife raised, a snarl on his lips. He wasn't wearing the leather strap that covered his severed nose, and without it, his gaunt face had a skull-like appearance. Y had been a fast, vicious man back in his Yellow Neck days, and he still was. But when he saw the intruder was Kyoshi, dressed in her full makeup and regalia, he gasped and nearly halted in midair. Y was one of the few witnesses who'd seen her in the Avatar state, and the experience had overawed the spiritual man. He stepped back to give her space, nearly knocking his brother over in his haste, and dropped to his knees. The knife that had been aimed at Kyoshi a second before, he placed at her feet like an offering.
Oh, come on,
Mok screamed as Y bowed his head to the ground and prostrated himself before the Avatar. Kyoshi stepped out of the city block into the street. The day had gotten brighter and hotter. A squad of peace officers, uniformed guardsmen of Bossing Se, waited for her, lining in wings to the left and right of the exit. The junior men who'd never seen the Avatar before stared at Kyoshi as she emerged from the darkness. One of them dropped his truncheon and fumbled to pick it up. Kyoshi walked past the rank-and-file guardsmen, ignoring the whispers and barely acknowledging the bows, until she reached Captain Lee by the door. He was a sallow-faced man who'd been on the job too long, his retirement delayed by gambling debts.
The cordon is set,
he said to Kyoshi in a pipe smoker's wheeze.
No trouble out here so far.
Most of the lower ring citizens went about their business, ignoring the presence of the law. But Kyoshi noticed a few people watching with fake disinterest, probably spotters for other unsavory organizations. Working with Captain Lee meant flirting with a violation of Kyoshi's Daofei oaths. She'd sworn to her elder sister Karima, under a blade held by her elder brother Wong, never to become a lackey of the law. But Lee had been her tool, her informant, not the other way around. He'd provided her the intelligence she needed to close her unfinished business with Mok, and numbers for cleanup once she was done.
Is the building safe?
Lee asked, tilting his cap to dab at his forehead with his cuff. The triad members are down and ready to be extricated, Kyoshi said. You should summon a doctor.
I'll get right on that,
Lee replied in a dull tone that let Kyoshi know how seriously he took the suggestion. He put his fingers to his lips and whistled.
All right, boys, get the vermin out of there.
The guardsmen hustled into the city block, free to move fast after Kyoshi had swept the twists and nooks of danger. She waited patiently to see the results of her work. The triad of the Golden Wing needed to be counted and cataloged in the light of day. Being hauled away like dry goods would cause their mystique to blow away in the wind. Hopefully. She heard loud voices and the sound of a struggle emerging from the darkness of Long Cao. Two officers dragged out a man who hadn't been among the triads who'd attacked her. He was dressed poorly, but a pair of glasses fell from his head. He had to have been a jeweler or a tailor to have invested in such an expensive device. A boot crushed the glasses into the dust before she could say anything. With mounting horror, Kiyoshi watched another set of officers come out, hustling a woman by the back of her neck. She held a wailing child in her arms. The man with bad vision heard the cries and began thrashing harder in the guard's grasp. These weren't triad members. They were one of the poor families who lived in the city block. "What are your men doing?" Kiyoshi shouted at Lee. He looked confused at her question.
"Getting rid of the bad element. Certain folks have been waiting to demolish this eyesore for a long time."
He turned hesitant, a haggler afraid to part with too much of his money.
Do you want a cut? If you do, you have to talk to my man in the middle ring."
The middle ring. In a flash, she understood. Someone with big lucrative plans for Long Cao wanted the residents scrubbed from the city block, but needed an excuse to do it. They'd let the triads in first to get the law and the avatar involved, and then bribed Captain Lee to clear out innocent and criminal folk alike.
"Stop this," Kiyoshi said. "Stop this right now."
"Ayah,"
Lee lamented without a speck of sincerity.
"I'm sorry, Avatar, but I'm acting within the confines of my duty. Rightfully, I can vacate these premises of criminals as necessary."
"Mama!"
It was the little girl's sobbing that set Kiyoshi over the edge.
"Papa!"
Kiyoshi drew her fans and snapped them open. She raised clumps of earth from below the dusty top layer, where the clay was still moist and malleable. Fist-sized clods shot forth, slamming over the mouths and noses of Lee and his officers, clamping over their skin like muzzles. The guards let go of the family and clawed at their faces, but Kiyoshi's earthbending was too strong to be resisted. Lee sank to his knees, his eyes goggling out. They had time before they would suffocate to death. Kiyoshi put back her fans and slowly went to each guard in turn, yanking off their headbands one by one, checking the square metal seals of the Earth King fastened to the cloth. The badges of every official in Ba Sing Se had identification numbers engraved on them, a testament to the city's massive bureaucracy. These men, despite the shrinking supply of air to their brains, could understand the gesture of her taking their headbands and tucking them into her robes for safekeeping. One visit to an administration hall, and she could learn their identities. She could find them later. Most residents of Ba Sing Se had heard the rumors. They'd heard stories of what Avatar Kiyoshi was and what she did to people. Kiyoshi saved Lee for last. He'd turned purple in the time she'd taken to make the rounds. After snatching his headband from under his cap, she let the clay fall from his mouth, and the others at the same time. Lee's squad dropped to the ground, gasping for breath. The captain landed on his side, and his inhalation rattled like dice in a cup. She leaned over, but before she could say anything, Lee threw a name at her, hoping to buy clemency. He really had no backbone.
"His name is Wu. The man paying me is Minister Wu."
Kiyoshi needed to shut her eyes so her frustration wouldn't leak out. There were probably a dozen Minister Wus in Ba Sing Se. The name alone was meaningless to her. The city was too big. The Earth Kingdom was too big. She couldn't keep up with the corruption leaking from its holes. She gathered her breath.
"Here is what's going to happen, Captain,"
she said as calmly as she could. You are going to clear the block of the triads, and no one else. Then you are going to find paper and brush. You will write me a full confession detailing this war person and every bribe you took from him. Every stroke of it, the truth. Do you hear me, Captain Lee? I will check. I want you to pour your very spirit into this confession. He nodded. Kiyoshi straightened up to see the woman and her daughter looking at her with wide, frightened eyes. She started to approach them, wanting to ask if they were hurt.
Don't touch them!
The man who'd lost his glasses threw himself between Kiyoshi and his family. With his near blindness, he wouldn't have seen her trying to help. Or maybe he had, and decided she was a danger to his wife and child anyway. Farther away, around the edges of the cordon, more bystanders had gathered. They whispered to each other, the seeds of fresh rumors taking root in the soil. The Avatar had not only ripped apart the occupants of Longkou, but she'd turned her insatiable wrath upon the officers of the Earth King's justice as well. The stares of the ordinary citizens and the terrified family made Kyoshi's skin prickle with a feeling that corrupt men like Lee or Mok could never force on her. Shame. Shame for what she'd done. Shame for what she was. Her makeup covered the flush in her cheeks and camouflaged the furrow in her brow. She gave Lee one last meaningful tap and then walked away from Longkou as slowly as she'd arrived. An impassive statue heading back to the altar that gave it life. But really, underneath her paint, she was fleeing the scene of her crime. Her heart threatening to pound her chest into dust. The Invitation. People who complained about how long it took to travel across Ba Sing Se were usually factoring in the congestion. That wasn't a problem for Kyoshi. Crowds tended to part out of her way, like grass before the breeze. She had another shortcut to exploit as well. It was possible to waterbend a makeshift raft upstream along the drainage canals running from the upper ring all the way out to the agrarian zone for irrigation. It was extremely fast if you could stand the smell. She reached the middle ring by the evening. Despite the orderly layout and numbered addresses, she struggled to find her direction in the uniformity of the white-painted houses and green-tiled roofs. She took paths leading her over peaceful bridges that spanned gently flowing canals and along tea shops redolent with jasmine blossoms and trees shedding their pale pink petals over the sidewalks. As a child living in the gutters of Yokoya, Kiyoshi used to imagine a paradise much like the middle ring. Clean, quiet, and food at hand anywhere you looked. Store owners sweeping their floors would look up in surprise at her, but soon returned to their business. She passed a gaggle of dark-robed students that stared and elbowed each other to get a glimpse, but didn't flee her gaze. People who were comfortable with their station in life tended to have less fear. They couldn't imagine danger in any form visiting their doorstep. Kiyoshi slipped out of sight into a darkened side street. She opened an unmarked door with a key she kept in her sash. The hallway she entered was as full of twists and stairs as Longkou, but much cleaner. It ended with a passageway into a plain second-story apartment, furnished only with a bed and a desk. This room was one of several properties around the Four Nations that Genju had bequeathed her. And it served as a safe room where she could sleep overnight when she didn't want to announce her official presence with the Earth King's staff. She unbuckled her bracers and peeled them off, tossing them on the bed as she crossed the floor. She sank into the chair and dumped the pilfered headbands on the desk,
the badges clattering over the surface like gambling winnings. She was more careful removing her headdress. A breeze rustled her freed hair, coming from the window that gave her an expansive sunset view of the lower ring in all its vastness and poverty. The brown shacks and shanties stretching over the land like leather, drying in the sun. It was an unusual layout for the apartment. Many middle ring houses did not have views that faced the lower ring. The merchants and financiers who lived in this district paid so they didn't have to look at unpleasantness. Her fingers moved on their own, organizing the badges into neat stacks. A dull ache of exhaustion settled into her head. Today had added another complication to the pile. She would need to plan another visit to Longkou to make sure the residents were safe within their homes, and she'd have to follow up on Lee's information, or else the captain and his backers would know they could simply wait until the Avatar had passed like a cloud overhead for them to resume their corrupt activities. She knew it was a losing battle. In the grand scheme of things, singling out one dirty lawman in Ba Sing Se would have as much effect as pulling a raindrop out of the ocean. Unless she made an example of Lee and whoever bribed him. She could hurt them so badly that word would spread about what happens when the Avatar catches you exploiting the defenseless for your own gain. It would be quick. It would be efficient. It would be brutal. Genji would have approved. Kyoshi slammed her hands against the desk, toppling the badges. She'd slipped yet again into the mindset of her deceased benefactor. She'd heard his words in her own voice, the two of them speaking with as much unity as the Avatars were supposed to be able to do with their past lives. She opened a drawer and pulled out a hand towel that had been resting in a small bowl of special liniment. Kiyoshi dragged the moistened cloth hard down the side of her face, trying to wipe away the deeper stains along with her makeup. A shudder of revulsion ran up Kiyoshi's back when she thought of how she'd smothered Lee with the exact same technique Genju had once used on her. She should have abhorred it, knowing exactly what it felt like to die slowly as your lungs caved in on themselves. In dealing with Lee, she'd slipped as easily into Genju's skin as she had her clothes. The ones that had also been a gift from him. She slammed her fist on the desk again and heard part of the joinery crack. It felt like every step she took as the Avatar was in the wrong direction. Kelsang would never have entertained violence as policy. He would have worked to improve the fortunes of the Longkou and Lower Ring residents so they could push back against Triad domination and Middle Ring exploitation. He would have acted as their voice. That was what Kiyoshi had to do. In essence, it was what Kelsang had done for her, the abandoned child he found in Yokoya. It was the right course of action and would be the most effective in the long run. It would just take time. A very, very long time. A knock came from outside. "Come in," she said. A young man wearing the billowing orange and yellow robes of an air nomad opened the door.
"Are you all right, Avatar Kyoshi?" Monk Jinpa said. "I heard a loud noise and... ah!"
The stack of letters he was holding went flying into the air. Kiyoshi whipped her hand around and around in a circle of airbending, corralling the papers with a miniature tornado. Jinpa recovered from his surprise and caught the pile of letters from the bottom of the vortex up, recreating the stack, but with the corners sticking out at all angles.
"Apologies, Avatar," he said when he'd secured her correspondence once more. "I was surprised by your, He gestured at his own face in lieu of pointing rudely at hers. She hadn't finished wiping off the rest of her makeup. She probably looked like a doctor's illustration of a skull with the skin halfway stripped. Kiyoshi grabbed the towel to finish the job. "Don't worry about it," she said as she worked the cloth along the corner of her eye, taking care not to get the compound that would dissolve the paint into it. In defiance of her order, Jinpa still looked worried. "You're also bleeding from your neck." "Yes, right." With her free hand, she opened a fan and aimed the leaf at the garrote wound around her throat. The shards of glass in her skin plucked themselves out under the force of her earthbending and balled into a floating clump that dropped to the floor when she switched her focus to a nearby pitcher. A tiny wriggle of water snaked out of the vessel and wrapped itself around Kiyoshi's neck. It was cool and soothing against the itch of the wound, and she could feel her skin knitting together. Jinpa watched her heal herself, both worried and horrified by the crudeness of her self-administered first aid. "Isn't healing water supposed to glow?" he asked. "I've never managed it." The mansion's libraries in Yokoya were full of extensive tomes about the medical uses of waterbending, but Kiyoshi lacked time and a proper teacher. She'd read through as many of the texts as she could anyway, and the wounds she'd been accumulating as the Avatar gave her plenty of opportunities to practice on herself. She'd made a vow. No matter how limited her knowledge was, or how flawed her technique, she would never again watch someone she cared about slip away in front of her while she did nothing. She tossed the water back in the pitcher and ran a finger over the marks left behind on her neck. "At this rate, I'm going to look like Auntie Mui's latest patchwork quilt." She could hide the scar with more makeup or a higher collar. But the mottled, healed burns on her hands, courtesy of Xu Ping An, reminded her she was running out of body parts to injure and cover up. "What are the updates?" Jinpa took a seat and pulled out one of the many letters addressed to the Avatar that he'd already broken the seals on. He was allowed the privilege. During her first visit to the Southern Air Temple as the Avatar, he had helped her constantly with planning and communication, to the point where his elders shrugged and officially assigned him to Kiyoshi as her secretary. Without his assistance, she would have been overwhelmed to the point of shutting down. "Governor Te humbly submits a report that Zigan Village has surpassed its former peak population and can now boast of a new school and herbal clinic, both of which are free of charge to the poorest townsfolk," Jinpa read aloud. "Huh. The Te family's not known for generosity. I wonder what's gotten into young Sihung recently." What indeed? Te Sihung had been the first official of the Earth Kingdom to learn Kiyoshi was the Avatar, right after she'd decided not to assassinate him during a Dao Fei raid on his house. After her public revealing, she'd made it clear to Te that the life debt he owed her still applied, and she'd continued to watch him. Knowing his power didn't make him immune to consequences seemed to have bolstered both his compassion and skill as governor. Good news was hard to come by these days. "What's next?" she asked Jinpa, hoping for more. His lips pulled to the side. "The rest of the letters are audience requests from nobles you've already rejected or ignored." "All of them?" She eyed the tall stack of papers and frowned. Jinpa shrugged. "You reject and ignore a lot of nobles. Earth Kingdom folk are nothing if not persistent." Kiyoshi fought the urge to set the whole pile of correspondence ablaze. She didn't have to read every message to know each one was a demand for the Avatar's favorable judgment on matters of business, politics, and money. She'd learned after the first few times. Kiyoshi would accept an innocuous invitation to attend a banquet, preside over a spiritual ceremony, bless a new canal or a bridge. Inevitably, her host, the governor or the largest landowner, oftentimes the same person, would corner her into a side conversation and beg for assistance in material affairs they would never have bothered Kuruk or Great Yangchen with. But Kiyoshi was one of their own, wasn't she? She understood how business was done in the Earth Kingdom. She did. It didn't mean she liked it. Sages who'd vehemently denied her avatar